So I just went to a routine checkup and the doctor couldn't find the heartbeat. She wouldn't tell me anything, even though I clearly saw there wasn't a heartbeat. She kept saying, well, I see a flicker. And I'm like, well, a flicker isn't a heartbeat. So I needed someone to say, like, your baby is dead. I needed someone to give me that reality. My husband was at the park with our daughter, just playing on the slide. I just texted him, like, the baby's not alive. I'm calling you.
Welcome back to A Fresh Story. This episode is part of a special series for October, as it is Pregnancy and Infant Loss Awareness Month. We are honored to hold space for these profound conversations and share these stories. These stories may be of grief, but they are also of hope, resilience, and most of all, unconditional love. As a reminder, be gentle with your heart, and if you are not able to listen to this episode at the moment, we understand, and we're holding you close. These conversations will change you as they have changed us. I'll let these amazing women tell you in their own words.
So it is the 24th of November of 2001. So it's the day before Thanksgiving in 2001. And it's 10:06 p.m., which is ironically my birthday. So very bizarre. But I tweeted, Twitter, I don't know you that well, but I also like to be disarmingly real. I'm about to birth a dead baby. And like, please send me all your love, please. This red popsicle really isn't healing my big sads. And there's a picture of me staring off in a hospital gown about to lick a red popsicle.
That's Ray Jagger. Ray Jagger is a writer, former doula and yoga teacher, a nursing student who lives outside Cincinnati, Ohio. I first met Ray on Twitter. Her tweet randomly appeared on my Twitter timeline, and it was the one you heard. She was tweeting while she was losing her child. Her son Fox was stillborn on Thanksgiving Day 2021. When we were putting these episodes together, I immediately thought of Ray as I followed her journey since that tweet. In the last 2 years, her life has changed in so many ways. We've become social media friends, and I reached out to her to invite her to talk about Fox. And really, I wanted to know more about that tweet. My first question was, why the tweet? Where'd she get the popsicle? And what was the reaction like from Twitter? She told me everything. I specifically asked Ray about using the term dead baby in the tweet, and what she said may surprise you.
It's so funny. Like, I asked the nurse for a popsicle because typically you're not allowed to eat anything when you are in labor about to have a baby, but also that doesn't really matter when your baby isn't alive anymore. So they just kind of humored me and they were like, yeah, I mean, you can have all the red popsicles you want. And why I posted this on Twitter, I don't know. It was like almost like one of those moments where the spirit moves you. I felt so alone in that hospital bed that I felt like I needed to connect to the greater world in whatever way I could. And for some reason, it wasn't Facebook, it wasn't Instagram, it was Twitter at the time. That's what I chose to reach out to. So I closed my app and I was like, okay, it's time to go to sleep because the epidural's going, you know, the baby will be born not quite yet, but fairly soon. And what am I going to do with my time? My husband was laying next to me, just kind of crying in between sleeping, and I could not sleep. I did not want any sleep medicine. So I just put down my phone and then I casually picked it up maybe 5 minutes later to see that there were already over 1,000 likes. I mean, it was within seconds that people were liking the tweet and responding, and the fastest people to respond were other lost parents. I think within maybe an hour, someone responded a picture of their own stillbirth. And then it just became kind of I don't know if this is PG, it was a shit show. It was, you know, at the time, right after COVID, which we all know now that COVID wasn't over years later. At the time, there were even anti-vaxxers trying to like piece together the story, finding old pictures of me after I got the COVID vaccine and posting them on on Reddit already and Facebook. Within hours, there was a meme created of me. And that, yeah, and that, those people were in argument with people that were like, oh my God, this poor lady, this poor woman, this happened to me, or this happened to me 40 years ago. So it was almost like every walk of life found a way to connect to me with whatever they knew how. Like there were people saying, my dog died. I know how you feel. I just lost my baby. I lost my dad. I know. I tried not to be bitter about the dog ones, but like it was people trying so hard and being well-meaning to just connect to me and make me feel like, okay, you're not alone. And I just found that so touching. Yep, I had 700, I remember, I had 701 followers on Twitter. Mostly what I tweeted about before that was writing related because I'm a published poet. I've had some essays published, just little things, nothing that ever got more than maybe 50 likes on Twitter. But this, with no anticipation, just blew up so quickly. And I think within that evening, it was up to well over 23,000 likes. And there were people retweeting it and saying things. It was just, it was really hard to keep track of because my app at one point kept crashing because it couldn't handle all of the people trying to also DM me. I mean, there were people, there were other poets who were moved to send me flowers from across the world. People sending me gift cards. Like they just felt so bad for me that they wanted to do anything. And it was such a testament to, the reminder that people are good, but also it helped to ground me in the fact that something really bad happened because I could not process that I was about to have a dead baby. I kept thinking, he's going to take a miracle breath. It was Hanukkah. It was early Hanukkah. And I'm like, oh, the miracle of Hanukkah really messed with my head. Like I was like, this baby is going to take a miracle breath. It's going to be a Hanukkah miracle. And like, I wasn't religious then. I'm not super religious now, but I really cling to this idea of like, divine intervention, you know, like, oh, in the Greek myths, the god comes in and just like helps the person who's drowning. Something will be okay. It'll be okay. Because my whole life, that sort of thought process worked for me. And this was the first time I had to completely come to terms with the reality that something bad was happening, that no one was going to help me fix it, or there was no turning back. And that this is like, I was truly on my own. It made me feel less alone and it helped me come to terms with the fact that I'm about to have a dead baby. And that is what's going to happen because, and I've said this before, and I've said this in a couple of the essays I've written that I hope people will go find and read, you know, if they've been through this. Yeah. And it'll be like a huge comfort. But one of the things is like, it is impossible for the human brain. And as a pre-nursing student now, like doing all the neurology stuff and like learning about that, it makes a lot of sense. It's so hard for the brain to process something so quickly. Like the amount of time you're in labor to having a baby is not enough time to come to terms with the fact that, oh my gosh, my baby is dead and there's no medical intervention for that. They can't reach in with a little AED machine and jumpstart the heart. But you don't really know that at the time. You're just like, you're so hopeful because we're taught that if we like pray and we do these things, maybe we can change the outcome. So much pressure is put on us as moms. Maybe we did something. Maybe we can change it. And in reality, bad things happen. Unfortunately, no matter how you've lived your life, no matter what your beliefs are, and no matter who is there to support you. I forced myself to do it because I had to come to terms with the fact that stillbirth and miscarriage are these kind of heady, they're not abstract, obviously, they're real things that happen, but it's almost like you get so lost in the medical terms of things that it keeps death at length. And I needed the reminder that when a baby dies, it's against nature. It's not like, you know, we expect a grandma to die or a father. Like my dad died the year before Fox. We expect that to happen because we know that we're in theory going to outlive our parents. But when the opposite of nature happens, which it's, you know, it's obviously still nature that we lose babies. It's horrible, but it's still, you know, something that happens in nature too. But for me, I needed to remind myself that this is truly a tragedy because I kept trying to silver line myself. So dead babies, saying that immediately helped me. And it honestly helped me filter out the people who couldn't handle it, the people who couldn't be supportive, and the people who just couldn't understand that I was going through. By saying dead babies, it almost like was a magnet for the people who knew what I was going through and had the like chutzpah to deal with it.
I asked Ray to take us back to the beginning. What is it like to hear somebody say that your baby has no heartbeat? What's it like to go home without your child? And how do you keep moving through life? What's it like to bury your child and plan a funeral? How do people support her after her loss? I wanted to know what that moment is like, leaving the hospital without your baby, how that completely transforms you. And how did her Judaism inform all of this? How did she change after the loss and death of her child?
So I just went to a routine checkup and the doctor couldn't find the heartbeat. And she tried on multiple machines and she kept going, I don't know what's going on. She wouldn't tell me anything, even though I clearly saw there wasn't a heartbeat. She kept saying, well, I see a flicker. And I'm like, well, a flicker isn't a heartbeat. So I needed someone to say, like, your baby is dead. I needed someone to give me that reality so that I could work towards accepting it. So what she did is she sent me to labor and delivery. My husband was at the park with our daughter, just playing on the slide. I hadn't called him in an hour. He was very concerned I had either died in a car accident or there was something wrong with the baby. And I just texted him like, the baby's not alive. I'm calling you. So there was no easing him into it, obviously. Like, I wasn't eased into it. There's no kind, gentle way to tell him. So he had to get my daughter to grandma's house and pack all the things and feed the dogs and do all this stuff, kind of completely unaware of what was going on, probably wanting to do anything he could to help or be there. Now, I was at the hospital getting another ultrasound from a nurse, and the doctor left it up to her to tell me. And I kept saying, is the baby alive? And they were silent. You know, they're like, we're looking, we're checking. And finally, this lady put down the Doppler. She was maybe in her 50s. And, you know, this had maybe happened to her a few times because she was like, no, the baby is not alive. And at that point, they were like, you can go back home and you can have Thanksgiving with your family. You know, come back and we'll do. I'm like, I'm a walking coffin. I don't want to be carrying my dead baby anymore. I want this to be over, you know, and it's not just over immediately. So at that point, it was like, we'll induce you. I asked to be as numb as humanly possible. I remember repeating over and over again, like, I know you can numb my legs. Is there a way to numb my brain? Can you numb my hurt? Like, can you just hit me on the head with a rock? I feel so bad for the nurse. You can see in their faces how badly they wanted to be a human for me, but they also wanted to be professional and show some sort of like resilience to show me that it was going to be okay. And at that time, I was alone at the hospital. A friend was coming to sit with me, and she was kind of, her response to me later was like the mom that I needed. I really needed just like someone to pet my head and give me Kleenexes and tell me it was okay. And my mom was not there. So I was waiting to go to a hospital room. I was in triage, and they asked me if I wanted to be alone, and I begged them to stay with me. And one thing that every lost mom might not admit, but will in their heart of heart understand, is that you do not want to live anymore. When you hear the words that your baby is dead, you just want to die. And I just thought of all the ways that I could do that. And I knew that if the nurse was there, at least someone would witness the craziness. I mean, you feel just so crazy. You want to do anything. You want to crawl out of your body and run away so badly. Denial. Absolute denial. Oh, no, that can't be right. Why would that happen? This is a perfectly healthy pregnancy. Now, leading up to that, I will say most birthing people do not get stellar care. What happens is you wait, and you might remember this from your kids, is you go to a hospital or like a birth, wherever you go to your appointments, you sit in an office, you wait an uncomfortably long time. They measure your fundal height, so from like the top of your cervix to the bottom, then they go, any questions, mama? You listen to the baby's heart, and that's it. And this doctor was exactly like that. And I loved it for my daughter because I wanted like a hands-off epidural natural birth. And I got that. And I thought, I'm getting that again. And it was just so different to think, oh, this is a healthy, fine pregnancy. And then to be like smacked with, no, it's not. It's not a healthy, fine pregnancy. You're not fine. Your baby's not fine. It's just like so much to process that you can't do it all in even a day, a week. It's taken me years. And that's what's so hard, is this is just the beginning, you know, of a long, difficult journey of changing your entire life, where you have to slowly throw away all of the values and beliefs you had that no longer work. So my husband and I tried as best as we could to sleep. They offered me all sort of like sleep medicines. And I was like, no, I want to keep watching Twitter and see what happens. And then it was just, I'm like, well, give me something to kind of do. I didn't want to watch like a movie and see things that would make me cry. It was Thanksgiving Day at that point. It was like, I want to say 1 p.m. I had sat up all night just staring at the Twitter stuff, and it was pretty close to birthing the baby. And I will say the nurses say the same things here where I was. I don't know if all nurses do this. Hopefully not. They say the same thing when you're birthing a live and dead baby. Like, go, mama, you've got this. I could see the baby. And you just, in your mind, again, it's a part of the trick that you think the baby's going to be okay. Oh, I'm being prepped to have a regular birth. I was laboring the day before Thanksgiving, and on Thanksgiving Day, I gave birth to Fox. He was 32 weeks old. I didn't know what to expect when he came out. No one really prepares you for how to birth a baby that isn't alive, a dead baby. And I think it took until I was there with the nurses for them to explain to me multiple times, you want to hold this baby. Because for some people, especially in Christian culture, it's very normal. It's normalized to have like open caskets, and you like, you deal with death and you get your final goodbyes. But in Judaism, you have a closed casket, and you want to remember someone as they are living. And it doesn't have space in that faith necessarily for a baby that isn't alive. So when the hospital says to a Jewish person that has been raised within that cultural sort of knowledge that, oh, you want to hold your baby and say goodbye, it was a huge just like volcano that erupted in my life, because I had never seen anything dead before. I saw a cousin that had passed away, and it made me like physically ill to see that. So I had not had any experience really coming to, I didn't even see my dad after he died. I was like, you know what? Nope. I remember him when he was battling cancer, and that was hard enough. I don't want to see him dead. So when he came out, it was silent. You know, around you, you hear babies crying and moms crying like, oh, I could just finally get to hold my baby. You know, there's no like soundproof room that you're in. And this hospital, it was, I'm birthing with people birthing live babies, which is like a whole new level of torment you don't expect. Because no one really built the hospital system around people who are grieving, that's for sure. So I got to hold Fox. They went ahead and wrapped him up. He had some skull fractures because he, you know, he was coming down the birth canal as a loose-limbed dead baby. So those growth plates that kind of make a cone in a natural, organized way, it doesn't do that when you're birthing a baby that's not alive. The baby just came down sideways, honestly, like tumbled down. I'm sorry this is so graphic, but like I think it's so important to know that you're not having a normal labor and you're not having a normal delivery. You're around people that are having those normal things and you're having something different. And then you hear the silence. And you know your baby is in the same place where they put live babies. And they're getting the baby dressed. And you don't realize this, but you don't know if your baby's going to be partially mummified or how long they were dead in there until you. And some people choose not to go through testing. We did. We knew that he had died maybe the night before. And all movement after that was just like him swishing around, which is horrifying to know that a dead baby still moves. Like you still could feel movement. Or even phantom movement. So it's really hard and important to count your kicks. But anyway, so he came out and it was just like, we wanted to get out of there so fast, but the nurses had to have so many conversations with us, not about how baby goes home, how baby eats, but about like planning a funeral, about here's what our hospital does to memorialize the dead, about here's the kind of therapy you need, here's a brochure to give grandma, all this stuff. And we didn't have any visitors. My mom and my family were just so shocked, maybe also in denial, that they offered briefly to come to the hospital. My husband's parents were watching our daughter, and we didn't want them to bring her because we didn't want to. The whole experience kind of set her back emotionally by traumatizing her by watching us grieve. So we thought at the time the best course of action was to just kind of keep her there. And then tell her when we were home. So we were just really making decisions, really big life-altering decisions based on new information we had just gotten. Ben got the baby first, and he held him, and he was sobbing, and he was so light. You know, he was 2-ish pounds. He had lost all this weight from being growth-restricted. And that's when I guess it became real to start the grieving. I cried for 24 hours. The entire time I was there, I was crying. I maybe stopped to drink a little bit of water. I mean, that IV, I'm pretty sure, kept me alive. But holding Fox was like the one moment that I maybe stopped to cry a little to just see him and take in as much as possible, not fully processing that it was the last time I was going to see him. You know, because days after, we were going to bury him. And before that, someone was going to cut apart his little body to check every organ to see what could have possibly gone wrong. So that was the chance to have him. And he just seemed like he was sleeping. His skin had already started to change. They offer you a cuddle cot to keep the body cold. And I don't think we wanted to disrupt that process or see all the things that, like, happen. And that's, like, so traumatizing. It took so much EMDR to, like, soften those memories so that I didn't have dreams for, honestly, years after. I still have dreams sometimes, like, seeing his body, and I still know what it feels like to hold it. And that's, like, what gets me, talking about holding him, because that's the time I met him. And that's the only time I ever, you know, will have. And that's really what I mourn. The putting a face to this abstract baby that I grew in me, and knowing that, like, I inherently knew him from the inside out, but I didn't ever get the chance to, like, hold him and see him. And he was very cute. He had a little butt chin. And that is like the single reason why I think moms and dads post their babies so much, is that is the one moment that lives forever. That is the little legacy the family gets, is a picture, usually black and white, because it's from an organization called Now I Lay Me Down to Sleep, and they make the baby look less dead so it can, you know, go as a picture on your mantle. But that's all you get. You get that one chance. And you don't realize either how important that is. And as a Jew, I was like, I don't want to hold this baby, but I understand how important now. And I would have held him much longer. I would have, like, given him a bath, put him in a little outfit. Some people dance with their babies. And it reminds me so much of that story of the orca that lost its baby in the ocean and, like, pushed its baby for miles. I think it was, like, hundreds of miles pushing this dead baby, trying to hold on to it as long as possible. And it's just, like, every species, it's so hard to let go of the dead baby that you grew. Yep, empty-armed. I think it was really hard for me to, like, picture him the next week in, like, a morgue and getting all these tests done. That was so hard because my mind went there. It wanted to visualize that. I had been a yoga teacher. I was all about, like, let's visualize this meditation. Now my visualization was so good. A total, complete transformation. People talk about the hero's journey and, like, the heroic arc where, like, the hero goes into the underworld and all that. And I firmly believe it is a parent who loses a child that goes deeply into the underworld and comes out, and they are a complete different person, and they no longer have access to who they were before. So we wanted him to go at a graveyard nearest to us, because it felt like it was nice to have him near to us. So we actually buried him in a Catholic cemetery, and our rabbi came and did, like, a little memorial. And it was the weirdest thing ever, because Jews will take the shovel and they bury their loved ones themselves. Like, they throw the first dirt on it, and it's, like, the last chance to tuck your baby in, metaphorically. So, you know, my husband's family is Catholic, and they're watching this, and they're horrified. I didn't warn them. I'm like, y'all, I don't have the brain capacity to warn you what our customs are and how different they are. The funeral director was horrified. They were all Catholic people. Like, what is happening? Why is this rabbi talking about compassion and all this stuff during the most difficult? So we go there for just whatever small things. We try to visit with Ivy, and we make it fun. We'll lay out a blanket. We'll read books. She likes to play tag and jump over tombstones. And, like, it's a playground for her with giant bricks, and she doesn't really understand. And now we have a 7-month-old, and he lays on a blanket and stares up at the trees. And we just make it a fun outing. But other than that, we keep a picture of him on our mantle. And other beautiful trinkets people had given us from Twitter. Like, this wonderful woman gave us some, like, a matchbox with a little scene of a fox etched into it and painted. Another person gave us these beautiful stones that were carved into foxes. It's just, like, people did the kindest things. And those are all on display to remind us, like, in this horrible time, people are good, people are good, people are good. And then when we go on a trip or something, we always take Fox's picture with us just to have it there. It's almost like a comfort. I know a lot of families get these bears that are weighted to the same size as their babies, and I love that. But in my mind, I know that in the great beyond, wherever Fox is, he is growing older, and I don't want to keep him this little 2-pound bear. You know, I want to imagine him right now as an almost 2-year-old hanging out with my dad, you know, eating peanuts off the ground or something. So I think it's important for me to imagine him growing older, and having the picture is just like there as a placeholder for that reminder. So I think this was the hardest for my family to process, who were raised, especially my mom, who, you know, not she wasn't able to look at a dead picture of him because, oh my God, he's dead. I don't want to see it. The fear around coming to terms with something that is outside of her belief. So she found ways to be supportive after by like coming over and bringing lunch. But it was very isolating in the hospital, not having any family there. And I think at the time we also struggled with wanting it that way and not realizing we wanted someone to just sit with us quietly. And my friend Caroline Plaskett, bless her, she is a beautiful poet and writes essays too, and all sorts of beautiful fiction. She just came and sat with me, and she provided that like family. And she wiped my tears. She was there in a mask because COVID was still very much a thing. And she just sat there and kept saying, "Honey, you're cold because you're in shock. This is a horrible thing." And she was just so loving and exactly the maternal person I needed there. And then later, my two other writer friends, Krista Noel Kaufman and Sarah Moore Wagner, came over and cleaned my house. They brought a ton of food from Costco. Like, they just took such good care of us when we weren't able to like clean a toilet or wash a mirror. You know, they cleaned everything. They swooped in. They didn't ask us any questions. They didn't like expect anything of us. They just literally gave their time and love, and I will never forget that. And then there was the other layer of strangers who came forward, people who were like, "This therapy really helped me after," or "Here's what happened to me, here's my story." And it really helped me to hear those. I found an organization of other lost moms, and they were just kind of there to remind me to do the least shitty thing possible when I make decisions after. And then there were our friends who, like, we might go to events with, but not people that really know the intimate details of our life, not super close friends, but acquaintances. And we received over $1,000 in DoorDash gift cards, like people who just wanted to do anything because they felt so bad. So more than anything, it was like people wanting to send us something to make us feel better, but they didn't know how to support us in like a physical, in-person way. And honestly, had this happened to a friend of mine and not me, I don't think I would have known. I would have done the same exact thing. So it was a really huge learning experience.
Ray has since gone on to have another child. And I asked her, what's it really like to be pregnant after such an enormous loss? She was pretty honest with her answer.
It's a mental anguish in a marathon way. You at any moment think your baby is going to die, and you literally have to live minute to minute, even if your baby's totally healthy. Sai was the healthiest baby, always chunky. Everything was running great. We did so many scans. They were weekly towards the end of the pregnancy. And yet, I still thought at any moment there's going to be a cord accident, going to have another stillbirth. And there's no way to take your mind out of that thinking. The only way is to literally be so present. And that you are getting to know your baby, and at the same way, staying present enough that you're not letting the spiral of mind games take a hold.
Ray's life has changed a lot since Fox's death, and I asked her how she has changed and how she continues to honor him as she moves through this world.
Yeah. So, in like a micro way of everything that affects my life, like the little decisions. There's acceptance and commitment therapy, ACE, and it is there's something called choice point, and it's where there's a little circle and there are two arrows pointing off in different directions. And I forget what the arrows stand for. I'm not a therapist. One is like your actions and ones are your value, and you want them to be going in the same directions. You don't want cognitive dissonance. You want to take actions that are based on your values. So I realized for most of my life, I had been a member of the holistic community who thought, if I just do certain things, I can manifest the great stuff that will happen to me. And most people, I think my age, who are liberal young women, probably feel that way, that you can influence the path of your life if you're just healthy enough and you work hard enough. But in reality, I had to accept that you don't always get to choose what happens, no matter how healthy you are or whatnot. There are invisible strings sometimes at play, and I don't mean like God determines what happens, but sometimes things don't work out the way you want. And I had to review my values in every single one of them. One of them was, I no longer believe that you can manifest everything, or I no longer believe that you should take any single amount of time for granted. So little things. So I had to like kind of change my whole belief system, basically. I was a natural birther. I even wanted a home birth. So I went from believing and being a part of that community as a birth doula, and after believing home births are just for people who they hit all of the right boxes. And as soon as they come high risk, you're not a home birther anymore. And no one talks about that. And no one preps you for what goes wrong in birth. They just say, I don't want to hear your story. I'm trying to protect my peace, which is fine and wonderful. But like we create these veils around ourselves, and all the veils had been lifted for me. And the bigger thing is, I now needed to make my life have meaning in a way that honored Fox. So in the greater sense, you know, I changed all my little values around to be consistent with what I believed now. In the greater sense, I wanted some sort of work that supported and was almost in a way like parenting Fox. And it wasn't being a birth doula anymore or being a yoga teacher. Like, those are things I could do for myself, but I can't just go work a birth where someone is having this huge transformative moment without being so deeply triggered. So I thought, like, I would like maybe to go back to school to be a nurse, and my focus can be hospice or something that holds space for Fox and something that honors him. And I didn't know how that would work, but I'm currently trying to live that life now. I mean, it's one thing to talk about the birth story, to talk about how the veil is lifted and you have to learn how to live in a new way. It's another thing to say, how am I going to honor my baby? And you don't have to do this. Not everyone has to make meaning in like a huge transformative way. Just as long as they find some sort of meaning for themselves. It can be personal. But for me, it was, I want to be a nurse, and that time is the greatest honor that I don't get to parent my baby anymore. So, and I'm having so much fun taking these classes. Holy shit. I thought my whole life, I'm just a writer who's not capable of doing these like science and math classes, and I'm having a ball.
Thank you, Ray, for sharing your story with us. We are so proud of you for the way that you chose to honor Fox. And thank you for sharing Fox with all of us. We will remember him always. To read Ray's writings about loss and grief and Fox, you can check out the show notes of this episode or the blog post. A Fresh Story is produced by Fresh Starts Registry. A heartfelt thank you to all of the women who shared their stories in this special series. And a special thank you to Alex Mooney, who has been our special consultant for these episodes. If you are experiencing pregnancy or infant loss, we hope that these episodes helped you feel a little bit less alone. We love you, and we are holding you close.